SWIFT isn't the only way for Russia to do business abroad. I'm David Brancaccio. Over the weekend, the U.S. and Europe moved to cut many Russian banks out of the SWIFT global payment system. Now, that's a messaging network to track who paid whom almost anywhere in the world. Sanctions are a punishment designed to force Russia to rethink what it's doing in Ukraine, but that strategy carries risks, including the chance that de-SWIFTing could push Russia toward China. I'm joined by Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pak in Shanghai. Greetings.
Hi, David.
All right, so an alternative for Russia could be China's what's called cross-border interbank payment system, acronym SIPS. How's it work?
Well, China's SIPS connects participants inside China and out to do trade or investment and then settles those transactions using Chinese yuan.
Well, how's that different from the SWIFT global payment system based in Belgium?
Right. So let's say I sell you shoes. Normally, you'd reach for PayPal to settle it in U.S. dollars, right? But instead, you could use SIPS and pay me in Chinese yuan. And it actually relies heavily on SWIFT's financial messaging services. So you can think of SIPS as being enhanced by SWIFT rather than working against it.
But in the Chinese currency, and that's key, what kinds of institutions currently use the SIPS system?
Well, SIPS says they have roughly 1,100 financial institutions from 100 countries, but they're mostly from China and also ones from Russia.
Now, there's concern that as Russia is cut off from SWIFT, it could increase Russia's reliance on this Chinese payment system. Is it feasible that Russia could effectively cushion the blow of being cut out of SWIFT by turning to this alternative system?
It's feasible in theory, but not in practice just yet. For example, SIPS has its own messaging function, but this is going to take time to build up. And then the Chinese currency isn't as popular. Just 3% of global payments in January on the SWIFT network were in Chinese yuan versus 40% in U.S. dollar. Plus, SIPS might not be an alternative if foreign sanctions are against individual banks.
I see. Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pak, Shanghai. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Crude oil traded in New York just crossed above $100 a barrel just now, up 4.6% today, given distortions that followed Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That's the highest since mid-2014, but crude prices back then crashed down after that peak amid new U.S. domestic production of fossil fuel. The oil producers cartel OPEC is meeting tomorrow, but Reuters sources suggest there will be no increase in production to take the edge off prices, despite everything. Russia's economy is about the size of New York State's, big, but not even top 10 in the world. Dr. David Kelly is chief global strategist at JP Morgan Funds.
Russia is a big exporter of energy, particularly to Europe, and also a big exporter of food, and so is Ukraine. So one effect of this could be, and I think we're already seeing this with oil passing $100 a barrel today, is this could add further fuel to inflation going forward.
Yeah, and I'm hearing you. You didn't just say natural gas and oil. Russia, Ukraine, big exporters of things like vegetable oil, particularly sunflower oil, and those prices are going up globally.
Well, that's right. And it just adds to our supply chain problems all over the world. And, you know, one very sad aspect of this is if you think about it, lower and middle income people spend more of their income on energy and food. So this is going to hit a lot of poorer people in the world pretty hard.
All right. David Kelly, chief global strategist, JP Morgan Funds. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
The United Nations estimates between 3 and 5 million people could be displaced in the coming months by the war. The UN has come up with $20 million from its Emergency Response Fund for humanitarian help for Ukrainians as it tries to raise $2 billion. Here's Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes.
In the city of Lviv in western Ukraine, the train station is overrun with people, says James Elder, a spokesperson for UNICEF.
Where you walk up the stairs to a platform, just absolutely heaving, and then people are on tracks trying to cross and find ways.
Lviv is about 50 miles from the Polish border, and Elder says people are coming through from Kiev.
They've left elderly family who couldn't or wouldn't leave, carrying what they can on a train or driving.
He UNICEF, which is part of the UN, has been operating in Ukraine for 8 years, since the last Russian invasion. It's scaling up efforts to help displaced people, and it's asking for funds to provide them with things like healthcare, clean water, and psychological support. Susanna Campbell runs the Research on International Policy Implementation Lab at American University. She says these basic needs fall into what are called the sphere standards.
It's a kind of minimal humanitarian need that everybody should have. And so that's what they're going to be looking at as their basic set of standards. And then on top of that, an assessment of, you know, what are the particular needs of people in Ukraine?
Campbell says that includes obtaining supplies, figuring out where they're needed, and getting them there. That can all be pretty complex.
Humanitarians are logistical masters.
They have to coordinate between the Ukrainian government, the UN, and any other groups working in the region. The aid community also needs to think about the long term, says Shelley Culbertson, who researches forced displacement for the RAND Corporation.
The vast majority of the people fleeing today are probably not going home.
Culbertson points to a study by RAND that found that 10 years after conflicts, on average, only 30% of refugees return to their countries of origin.
One of the worst things that can happen in refugee situations is when people flee, they think they're going back really soon, and their lives end up in limbo for years, decades, or generations waiting to go back.
Culbertson says they need support to build their new lives where they land. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
After a cyber attack forced Toyota to close all of its car factories in Japan yesterday, the company says it'll start reopening plants starting tomorrow. It's not known who did the attack, but it did happen soon after Japan joined the U.S. and Europe in sanctioning Russia. From Tokyo, here's the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
Prime Minister Kishida says Japan is investigating the origin of the cyber attack that hit a parts manufacturer called Kojima on Monday. The company is a major supplier of plastic parts and electronic components to Toyota. The world's biggest car maker says it is being forced to close production at all 14 of its plants in Japan, which will affect about one-third of its global output. Mr. Kishida has surprised many by giving full support to the US-led sanctions against Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. That includes the ban on certain Russian banks using the SWIFT interbank system.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes, BBC in Tokyo there. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.